This podcast is a production of The Orchard, a church community located in Aurora, Illinois, whose mission is leading people into a growing relationship with Jesus Christ. Visit us online at orchardvalleyonline.com.
It is great to be here today. I've said this in the two other gatherings prior to this. Your worship band is the best in-house worship band that I have ever heard. They really, really are. I'll tell you what, that Mike Jones, he's a beautiful man. I mean, there's something about bald guys with facial hair that's just like, I get a little weepy when I see him, you know? I mean, Taylor, he's okay for a hair person, but I tell you what, that Mike Jones, he's got it going on. I love that video. That's the third time I've seen it now. I think I'm using that. I'm asking them to use that to introduce myself to my wife every morning, you know? So when I get out of bed, maybe before she makes breakfast, just have that video playing. I come out, thank you, you know, where's the eggs kind of thing. But no, it is really, I am honored to be here today. And I want to talk to you a little bit about story and about life, like Scott said on the video. About a year and a half ago, I heard a gentleman by the name of Don Miller give a talk on story. Now, Don Miller is an author. He wrote Blue Like Jazz, Through Painted Deserts, Searching for God Knows What. He's got another book he's working on. I think it's going to be released this spring called Story, Life is a Story. Well, I heard him give this talk, and this is one of those talks that change your life. And I know you're kind of used to that because I know your pastor. That when you hear a certain talk, it kind of rattles your world a little bit. It kind of shakes you up. It makes you ponder. It makes you think about things. And that's the way God's word is supposed to be in our lives. Well, I heard Don Miller give this talk, and it really started making me think about my life. I have been in full-time ministry for 23 years. And I know that shocks you because I'm only 29 years old, and I've been that long in ministry. You know, I started at 6. I was a prodigy. I mean, it was weird. It was just uncanny. But I've been full-time ministry 23 years, and I have worked at some great communities and great churches. I've worked in the city of Chicago, in Brooklyn, New York. I worked in a small mining community in southern Indiana. And I've been blessed to be around the people that I have been. But I really got thinking about my life and my ministry, and I thought, man, I'm just become very comfortable. Yes, I'm working for God, and I always consider it an honor to be able to be a professional minister. Isn't that what I mean? That I am able to make a living. I'm able to feed my family and put a roof over our head out of God's tithe. And that's a very humbling thing for me to be able to do that. And I never take that for granted. But I was thinking about my life, and I was like, I've just become comfortable. And the danger of becoming comfortable is that a lot of times comfort leads to complacency. And that's where I had become on my journey. So I started digging into this more. Don Miller inspired me. I started thinking about story and about my life. And is my life a good story? Is the story of my life worth retelling to someone else? Now, I don't read a lot of novels, not as many as I should. I read some. I read some F. Scott Fitzgerald here about a month ago. He's an author. And I read him about a month ago. And I read Crichton. Now and then, but I don't read as many novels as I should. I read a lot of nonfiction. So I'm going to be using some stories that I've read and some stories that I've seen on TV. And the great thing about seeing a story on television, it's like an hour and a half long. And, you know, it takes me like 5 days for a novel, but an hour and a half, and I can eat during it. It's hard for me to eat and read at the same time. My head joggling up, it's a mess. But so I'm going to tell you about a couple stories and some movies you maybe even have seen, like Batman. Good movie, right? Yeah? You know, Superman. Okay movie. He always, for some reason, Superman always kind of freaks me out a little bit, but it's the clothes, I think. But Hancock. Again, great movie. Good action movies, right? I mean, it just pulls you in. It's a good action adventure. But is it a good story? I mean, when I saw, how many of you have seen Hancock? The movie. Did you go buy the book? I got to read the book. Nobody does that. Nobody, it's an action movie, and it's good for a thrill, but it's not a good story. But how many of us want to live our lives like that? We want to live from one action scene to another, but when you look back, it's not really a good story. It may have been fun, but it certainly wasn't necessarily a good story. You know, there's nothing like a good story, because good stories inspire us. And when I think of good stories, I think of, you know, Lord of the Rings. I think of, you know, which is, you read that book? It's like War and Peace, right? It's long. But anyway, so I saw the movies on that one. But, you know, The Great Gatsby, The Bourne Identity. For some reason, my wife loves watching The Bourne Identity. I haven't quite figured it out, but she's just asphyxiated. I try to talk to her, and she's like, you know. Every time this Matt Damon fellow gets on TV, she just, like, stares at it. I've yet to figure it out. And Braveheart, again, one of my favorite movies ever. And they're good stories, too, but they're not great stories because they're not real. Yes, William Wallace was a real character in Braveheart, but the whole story was based upon a few hundred-year-old poem. That's what the whole thing was based upon. No, the great stories, what makes the story great is real. There's something you can connect with it. You know, Hotel Rwanda, Schindler's List, Band of Brothers by Stephen Ambrose. These are the great stories. You see, I'm inspired by good stories. But the great stories change us. Back in 1976, when I was just a wee little lad, I saw the movie Rocky for the first time at a drive-in theater. Now, a drive-in theater, for those of you that don't know, it's one of those big screens, right? It's not the little TV on the back of your minivan's headrest, okay? That's something completely different. And so I saw this for the first time, and I was really inspired by Rocky. So much so that when I came off my family vacation from seeing that, I went home and I bought a gray zippered sweatshirt. Yeah, I promise this is the truth. And I said, I'm going to run. And so I started running. And I got about two blocks down the road. I stopped. Running is hard, apparently. And I said, that's okay. So I walked back home. And now this is a kid that had I never once achieved my presidential physical fitness patch, okay? For those of you that laughed are as old as me, because if you're younger than me, you have no idea what he's talking about. But I never once received that. I said, I'm gonna do push-ups. You know, Rocky did push-ups, I'm gonna do push-ups. And I did about 9 or 10, and I quit because apparently those are hard too. See, I was inspired by Rocky, but man, I tell you what, Rocky certainly didn't change me because inspiration doesn't always lead to change. But I can be honest with you and tell you that when I saw the movie Schindler's List, I was changed. About the real life story of a gentleman by the name of Oskar Schindler that was pretty self-absorbed. He was a member of the Nazi Party until he saw the atrocities being poured out on the Jewish people. And he used his influence to buy Jewish people and use them to work in his factories that made dummy bombs, you know, for the Axis. And I was changed because there's that part of the other movie. Now, whether that exact thing happened, they said he did mention some things in his speech. I just saw an interview with one of the Jewish people that were there. But it didn't happen exactly like that. But at the end of the movie, you remember the movie? At the end where he just breaks down. And he says, you know, this ring could have bought one more Jewish person. That car over there could have bought 10 Jewish people. He just breaks down and cries. And I was really changed when I saw that story because I thought, God, how am I spending my life? Am I spending life, the resource you give me, on myself? Or am I using it for the freedom of others? I was changed when I saw the movie Hotel Rwanda by Paul Rusesa Abinga, the hotel manager, that during the genocide in Rwanda in the early 90s, how he, when the Hutus were going around and few of them had guns, they had just machetes, and they're hacking the Tutsi people to death, and it's just a slaughter, a genocide of people. Tens of thousands of people died. And Paul Rusesa Abinga took these people into his hotel to protect them and shelter them at the risk of his own life and the risk of his family. And I was changed by that. I was changed to give, put others before myself. I was changed when I read Stephen Ambrose's book, Band of Brothers, about the 101st Airborne Division, the Easy Company, of how these men gave their lives to each other and for you also, that we could have a free nation again. You see, when I read the good stories, yeah, they inspire me, but it's the great stories that change us. So what makes a great story? Well, I recently read a book by the author James Frey. And James Frey wrote a book on how to write a good novel. So I read this book, and he talks about the elements of a good story. And the first element of a good story that you have to have in every good story is a good character. It does not matter if you like the character at first or not. Eventually, you have to warm up to the character. There has to be something that you can identify with the character. There has to be something that you can relate to. And there's one thing that Miller says that a good character cannot be. It's selfish. The character can make selfish decisions, but ultimately, a good character has to make selfless decisions to make that character good. The second thing that Frey says in his book on how to write a good novel is you have to have conflict. There has to be something abrasive in the story. There has to be something in the story that is a challenge to that character that you like. Let me tell you a story that I just really made up. You weren't supposed to laugh there. I was just checking my notes. Billy and Judy decided to go to the beach. But they went by Judy's house, picked her up. They packed a picnic lunch, went to the beach, laid out in the sun, ate their picnic lunch, and they enjoyed the day together. At the end of this day, on the beach, Billy and Judy packed up their goods, including their recyclables, and put them back into their car and drove home. Billy dropped Judy off. They hugged each other. It was the end of their perfect day. Would you buy that book? I mean, seriously, would you buy that book? Gotta find out more about Billy and Judy. I mean, that story stinks. I mean, there's no conflict. There's no tension. There's nothing they had to overcome. It's like this Billy and Judy, they're kind of into each other. They probably enjoyed it, but I tell you what, reading the story, that was awful. Ah, but let me tell you a different ending, an alternate ending for you DVDers. Billy got back in the car, and as he drove home from Judy's house, he looked in his rearview mirror. He noticed in his rearview mirror that the car that was following him was the exact same car that followed him that morning. Ah, what's going to happen? Why is that car back there? Is it a coincidence or is somebody tailing Billy? Scott will explain the end of that story next week. But, I mean, there's some kind of tension. There's something that pulls you in. There has to be something. If I pick up a novel, if I start watching a movie, and it's just kind of blasé, and there's no tension, there's no conflict, is that a good story? And yet, so many of us, we flee from conflict in our lives. This is going to shock you. I am not a runner. Who knew? To look at me, you'd think, that guy probably runs marathons. I tell you, I run if somebody's got a pizza in front of me or a knife behind me. I mean, somewhere in between, that is the only time I run. I do not like running. I mean, I run from it like the plague. I go to the gym a couple days a week, but I'm not one of those people on those little ellipticals, you know. Those people are a different culture of people to me. I look at them, kind of wave them, I walk in, I'm like, I'm not doing that. Standing in one place and sweating for no reason? I don't think so. But to be a good runner, you have to do what? Run, thank you. It's not a hard question. You know, you have to run, and you have to do something that you don't want to do, and you have to take your body through this conflict. I mean, you have to in order to be a good runner. And it is much like that in life. It is the difficulties in life. It is the hardships in life. Aren't those the things that refine us? Aren't those the things that make us better? And when we see that character in that good story that we're observing go through conflict, we want to know how that character handles conflict. Because how you handle conflict shows whether you have character or not. And the last thing that Frey says in his book, to have a good story, is a good premise. The character in the story, there has to be a good purpose. There has to be a good premise. If we don't have that, if there is no good premise, if there is no good purpose, we live life only completely for ourselves. Oscar Schindler, if Oscar Schindler would not have a good premise, if he would have been completely self-absorbed like it was in the beginning of that film, would we have ever heard about him? No, I doubt it. We would have never heard about him. He would have been just another selfish person that walked the earth. Another person that turned their back why hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered. But because Oscar Schindler had a greater purpose, he found a greater premise in his life, we heard about Oscar Schindler. Had Paul Rusesa Abinga closed his doors to the Tutsi people, to the Tutsi tribe, had he closed his doors and said, no, I'm sorry, I can't help you, it's too great of risk, we would have never have heard about him. if the men of the 101st Airborne Division would not have took that stand when they were surrounded at Bastogne, a pivotal place, event in World War II, had they not taken a stand and literally frozen their limbs off and given their lives for each other, our world would have been quite different today. But because they found in themselves a greater purpose, a greater premise, their story is great, and their story is retold many times over. So Scott mentioned in the video that we're planting a church in Chicago. Well, why plant a church in Chicago? Do we really need more churches? Let me just run a few boring statistics by you. But in 1900, there was one church for every 357 people. That's a pretty good ratio in the United States. But with the population growth, the churches began to tail off because by 1950, there was one church for every 588 people. By 2000, there was one church for every 833 people. And now, by 2004, the last statistic that I saw, there was one church for every 909 people. According to some surveys, America is the third largest mission field in the world. If we were another country, we would desperately be training young people in seminary to send them overseas to America, because it's the third largest mission field in the world. A recent study of some churches showed that the best way to reach unchurched people is to plant new churches, because churches younger than 4 years old are baptizing an average of 31 people a year. Churches, established churches, are baptizing an average of only 9 a year. But let me commend the Orchard Valley Church, because your church baptized 120 people last year. Now, those of you that haven't been around churches too much, that is not the norm. And I commend you on reaching out to people and reaching out to people that are completely unchurched and coming to the knowledge of Jesus Christ for the first time. But they say that planting churches is the best way to reach unchurched people. Now, I told you that the national average is one church for every 909 people, but Chicago is quite different. In the Chicagoland area, there is one church for every 1,455 people. That by some estimates, just to reach the national average of churches to people ratio, we need 3,726 churches. In the two most predominant zip codes of the South Loop, just two zip codes, and the zip codes, one's a little larger, but one's actually a really small area, just in those two zip codes, we need 32 more churches. Not any particular denomination. In fact, this survey took account as any church that proclaims Christ. So it could be a Catholic church, could be a Protestant church. They need 32 more churches just to keep up with the population growth. So we're planting a church in Chicago. It's going to be quite the adventure. My feeling is, my belief is, that Jesus didn't just come to redeem individuals. He came to redeem cultures and communities. And the church needs to be right in the middle of that redemptive act. There is a great need in the South Loop of Chicago. If you go down there, I think the South Loop goes literally from about Madison, which is Millennium Park, to about Cermak. And in that 20-22 block span there is this wealth coming in. There's this wealth. There's these people building condos in this nice area, and there's affluency. But then you go one block over, and it's incredibly poor. And you see in the city, and you know this, that welfare is destroying a culture. There's times when welfare is good, and if you are on welfare or your family is on, I'm not to criticize that at all. But what happens is welfare that is taken advantage of, that is used from generation after generation after generation, tends to build a lethargy in a culture of people. And people don't, there is no willingness to get out and have meaning in their life. And so my contention is that both the wealthy and both the poor in the South Loop, without Christ, have no meaning. They both are living meaningless lives. And what we want to do, we want to take a group of people and plant down there in the South Church and join with what other churches and other great communities are doing and combat that meaningless life. We literally want to just start one family at a time and take one family and say, if you are willing, we want to help you. We want to help you with tutoring. We want to help you with mentoring. We want to help you with job training. We want to help you so that not you can just help yourself, but that you can help those around you, because that is where we find our meaning, isn't it? When our story becomes a little bit bigger than ourself. I have a table out there in the lobby. I failed to mention this in the other two gatherings, but I have cards on that table. Feel free to take as many as you want. I need to print up more anyway. There's some things I don't like about them, so please take them. But the information is on there, correct. My cell phone number is on there. My email address is on there. And if you just know people in the city, then over the next 9 months, we're networking. We're coming to churches like this, and we're just networking. We want to get as much word out as possible because we want to start with a large group of people down there in the South Loop that are going in there to transform community. I want that church plant to be a part of my story. Because I have become comfortable in ministry. I have become even lethargic at times in ministry. And I want that kind of risk. I want my son to see his father taking God-sized steps. That were it not for God, there would be no place to plant my foot because there is no plan B. I want my son to be a part of a church of faith like that, that does those things. And I want to eliminate the what-ifs at the end of my life. Oh, there will always be what-ifs. What if I would have done this? What if? But I don't want to die that way. I don't want to die with anything in the bank. Lord, I don't want to be Oscar Schindler. I don't want to be that person that says, Lord, I should have risked more. Even if it took a risk and it failed, God, I should have risked more. I told you I lived in the city too. There's something about it. I was down at 31st and King, which is the Bronzeville neighborhood, I believe, the other day. And I tell you what, it was cold. And I was just walking around, and I was like, this is my home. You know what that feeling's like? When you're walking around, you're like, this is where I belong. I love living in Frankfort. We have a great house God has blessed us with. But I really belong in the city. The city is a part of my story. But I've said enough about me. I want to ask you about your story. Because whether by intent or by accident, your story will affect other people's story. How many times have I heard someone say, my father was an alcoholic? And you know in the words of the way they said it, that it changed their story. Or that my mother had an affair and she left us. And you know you can hear the pain in their story. Or you might have just been driving down the road and you didn't see that person pull out in front of you and you hit them in your car. You altered their story instantly. Your story, by accident or intent, will affect other people's story. So what kind of story are you writing? What's the premise? What are you living for? And is what you are living for, is that worth dying for? Because you know what? If what you are living for isn't worth dying for, you might consider living for something else. Because it's not really much of a life at all if you're not willing to give everything for it. You know, one of my favorite movies, I mentioned that Braveheart was like my all-time favorite, but one of my favorite movies is Stranger Than Fiction. Have you seen this movie? You need to Netflix it. Don't download it illegally off the internet, kids. But the Stranger Than Fiction, Will Ferrell's character plays in one of the few cleaner movies, which that's a disclaimer. If you have a complaint after you see the movie, talk to Scott Hodge. He'll be willing to, I think it's what, scott.hodge at theorchardvalley online. I mean, just email him this week if you would, if you like the movie. But in this movie, Harold Crick is just like this OCD IRS agent. Everything is the exact same mundane life day after day. He counts the number of times he brushes his teeth. Everything is the same. Until one day he hears another narrator's voice. He hears somebody that is narrating his story. And you know, he's like talking in the air, like, who's talking to me? Who's saying this? And he realizes that he's no longer in control of the story of his life, that someone else is writing his story. And the more he finds out about this author, he finds out that this author writes good stories, but always kills her characters off. Always. Has never written a story where her character did not die. And so he resists. He's like, wait a minute, no, Lord, I don't want to die. And so he tries to find out who the author is so he can get her to change the story. But the more he tries to find out who the author is, the more he realizes, in fact, when he meets the author, he realizes that that author writes incredible stories. So he hands his life over into the hand of the author. It's just a great story. It is a great movie. I won't tell you exactly what happened, so when you get off Netflix, you can be surprised. But if you've held your pen too long, if you have your pen with a white-knuckled grip, my challenge is to for you to let your pen go in the hand of a greater author. In our text today, in Hebrews chapter 11, the writer of Hebrews is talking in chapter 11 about these great stories, these real stories, these people that lived outside of themselves, and just goes through story by faith, by faith, by faith, by faith. Talks about Moses and David and Rahab, all these other great people that lived these great stories, but then it gets down to the end of that particular chapter and says they were willing to be stoned. That's the bad kind of stoning, not the good kind. Some would say good. But anyway, it's always bad. But anyway, once again, my ADD is kicking in. They would be willing to be sawed in two. They were willing to give their life because they knew that only together with you, the writer says to the recipients of the letter, only together with you, and I paraphrase, would they be able to complete the story, complete the task. And so the writer flows right into chapter 12 and says this. And it's not in front of me. There it is. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, these people that live this incredible story, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author. The author and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And this word the writer of Hebrews uses for author is archegos. And south of I-80, we'd say archgos or archgos. But the reason I even bring that word up to you for author is like archegos. It's the same word that we get our English word arch, like beginning, like archetype. An archetype is the originator. It's the first of that type. And so what the writer is saying, this author is not just the author that just wrote. The author is the founder of that story. They wrote the beginning of that story. To fix your eyes, not on what? Yourself and your own little story. Fix your eyes on the original author, because the thing about that original author, he's not just the author. He's what? The perfecter. And that author writes great stories. And you know what? Your story may be different than your story, be different than your story, and your story, and your story. And it is not ours to compare ourselves stories. Well, how come that person's story has this, or that person's story has this? That is not our job. Our job is to hand our pen to the author and say, God, you write my story. Jesus, you write my story, because you write great, perfect stories. Last I checked, the death rate in America is still 100%. You will die one day. Some of you way too soon. Some of you, not soon enough. But no, I didn't say that. Once again, email scott.hodge at... You will die one day, and you will only have a short opportunity to amend your story. Because then your story will be written for you. And how will your story be retold? They were safe. They lived a comfortable life. They left a lot of money to their grandkids. How will your story be told? I didn't intend to use this, and I don't want to exploit it. But I have a friend here today. He's one of my best friends. And I just sat 2 days ago at the funeral of his mother. And he retold her story. And his mother was an incredible woman. I always knew she was because of the way he spoke about her, his mother. But he preached her funeral, and he retold her story. And it is a story worth retelling. And even on her deathbed, even when she was losing it all, she was still praying for people around her. Great story. How will your story be retold? What kind of story are you living? Is it time you hand your pen back to the author and let your pen go? And it may be scary, and it may be terrifying, But let your pen go, because the author I know writes great stories. And you know what? We have this incredible advantage. Let me pause there for a second. One more illustration. My wife, she's not here today, so I can tell this story. She was here last night. This isn't being taped, is it? Okay, anyway. My wife, before we got married, she read Daniel Steele. I got to say, I've never read one of them. Really, okay? I may have watched Oprah a couple times, but I've never read Daniel Steele. And my wife, she would read the first chapter, and then you know what she'd do? Last chapter. She couldn't take the suspense. She'd want to know what happened in the last chapter. And she'll tell you she's that way. I can't take it. I have to read the last chapter. And then she'll go back and read the rest of the novel. We have a great advantage because our author has given us the last chapter. We have the last chapter. Because those tears that you're shedding now, one day they'll be dried up. That pain and that suffering that you're going through, one day pain is going to be no more. Because the dwelling of God will be with man, and we will be his people, and he will be our God. But he not only gives us the last chapter, he gives us the last line of the story, at least of this first part of our story. And that's simply this: well done. Those of us who've handed our pen to the author, those of us that resist have taken it back out of his hand, he says, well done, good and faithful. And that is the kind of story that I want to be a part of, because my story begins to look more like his story than anything I could ever write. And isn't that who we should be like? Let's pray together. God, I am so thankful. I am so thankful that you even allow me, that you suffered, that you died so I could even hand you my pen. That I could put my life in your hands. And Lord, on my best days, I'm terrified, God. Not of the city. I love the city. God, I'm terrified that I won't measure up. I'm terrified that I will fail. But God, those are the days that I reach for the pen again. Those are the days that I want to write the story, because somehow I think I'm a better writer than you. And God, I'm not. You are the writer. Jesus, you are the writer. And you have written our stories in blood. You have written our stories in sacrifice. Oh God, help us to turn our pens over to you, the stories of our life, that God, that our story would become molded, we become a part of your greater story, and a part of the story of the people in Hebrews 11, the people that look forward to a greater reward, that could be not received on our own, that could not be opened in a corner, but it would be opened together as we stand one day in your presence. Lord, there's got to be more than this life can offer. There has to be more than that. There has to be more. Lord, because you have made us for so much more. And your purpose for our life, your premise, and the character you want to build in us, even through all the conflict, is so much greater. God, I pray for this community of people. Lord, I am thankful for them. Lord, may this community of people, may they turn their pens over to you and allow you to write their story. Many individual stories written together to one great story of how you use these people to reach the world. May your blessing rest upon them. Amen. And thank you.